Hey everyone, thank you all for being here, and thank you Product School for having me. As Carlos mentioned, I'm Ketan. I really like this space, by the way. As I heard about this space like 2 days ago from another friend of mine when he said the Vault, and I was wondering, what is the Vault? And it sounded like a weird closed space, but this feels so cozy and nice to talk, and I'm super excited. But what I'm here to talk about today is enterprise product management, and I'm super excited to talk more about it. But why do I want to talk about enterprise product management? It's because when people talk about product management, they typically talk about consumer product management. You hear people talking about Uber, Facebook, Airbnb, and their products, but enterprise products get far little love. And so today, I want to change that, and I want to essentially give you all some sense of what it means to be a PM in a B2B space. A little bit more about myself. I have been a product manager for about 4 years now, and I currently work at Dropbox. Some of my more recent projects are around growth and analytics there. Prior to that, I spent more than 3 years working as a product manager for an enterprise software company called APT that got acquired by MasterCard. APT is an enterprise software company that built retail analytics software for large clients like Subway, McDonald's, Wendy's, and so on. Prior to that, I was actually doing a whole bunch of different things. I did a little bit of quant trading, I did a little bit of manufacturing. I actually got into product management totally by accident, and I loved it. And if you have any questions on what my past story was, grab me after the talk, I'll be happy to share it. Schooling-wise, I just finished grad school at MIT, and before that, I finished my undergrad at IIT in India. But I'm a huge fan, outside of work and everything else, I'm a huge fan of national parks and the great outdoors. Zion is my favorite national park, though the picture of me smiling there is from Bryce Canyon. Two really beautiful national parks. If you haven't been there, I would 100% recommend you guys to go. So, what does a product manager do? That's kind of hard to answer. And depending on who you ask, the answer changes a ton. If you were to ask us PMs, we would say we were the Superman of the world, saving trains from getting derailed. But if you ask my engineering colleagues, they might tell a slightly different story. My mom definitely thinks I'm Steve Jobs, by the way. But really, if you really introspect as a PM, what we actually do sometimes is we're just like a bunch of headless chicken running around, not knowing what's going on. So instead of answering what does an enterprise product manager do, what I'm going to do today is really share with you all some stories and some of my experience in the past building and shipping enterprise products. And I want to do so including both of my past roles, because both of those I have some interesting stories to share with you all. And in doing so, what I want to do is give you all a glimpse of what it means to be in the shoes of a PM working on enterprise products. But I also want this talk to be useful. And in some sense, through the rest of the talk, I'll share some tips and takeaways that hopefully you guys can use as you step into your next PM role. So why talk about enterprise? Why is it interesting? Presumably, you're all here to hear about enterprise product management. So I guess I'm selling to a biased crowd here. But let's look at a simple indicator. VC funding of enterprise software startups. If you were to look at the trends in VC funding for enterprise software, that trend is generally rising very, very sharply. And as aspiring PMs or PMs, we need to care for two reasons. One is that it means that there are more interesting enterprise problems that are getting funding to be solved, which means that as PMs or aspiring PMs, there are more opportunities for us to build product solutions to solve those problems. And the second thing that this means is that there is more demand for people who have experience building enterprise products. So great, lots of funding, lots of opportunities, enterprise is awesome, right? So why talk about it? Because it's different. And as I mentioned, if you were to go look up on Medium, product management, or if you're to buy a book on product management, most of the time it's talking about consumer product management. And if you were to ask, what are the differences then between consumer products and the enterprise product? What are the differences between these two worlds? Fundamentally, most of these differences stem from the fact that in customer or in consumer products, you have lots of customers, often in the order of millions, whereas on the enterprise side, you have far fewer customers. Typically, it runs in the order of thousands or maybe even hundreds. And what that means is if you are on the consumer side of the world, you tend to pay far little attention or maybe no attention at all on an individual customer basis. You just look at your customers in aggregate. But on the enterprise side, you end up paying more attention on an individual customer basis. Consumer side, less revenue per customer. You may earn a few dollars or a few hundred dollars per year from a consumer product. But on the enterprise side, it's not unheard of to have 6, 7, 8-figure contracts being signed. Consumer products are self-serve. Your users will go download the app or the product from your web page or from the app store. But enterprise products are complicated. They take long times. They need to be negotiated. There's a direct sales team that navigates this. And enterprise products or adopting enterprise products involves pilots, contracts, SLAs. Whereas on a consumer product, we just hit, I agree to all user conditions and move on. So what are examples? I'm sure you can name a ton. But from Dropbox's perspective, Dropbox Basic, for instance, is a great example of a consumer product. We have 500 million users using Dropbox Basic, and it is all in all a consumer product. Dropbox for Business, on the other hand, when you talk about large enterprises, is more along the along that enterprise side of the world, essentially. But I can stand here and give you a long laundry list of what's different between consumer and enterprise. But really, what I want to do is focus on 5 things that you will do as a PM and talk more about how the enterprise world is a little bit different. I'll talk about generating ideas, building a roadmap, creating specifications or requirements, shipping products, and getting feedback. Now, some of you might say, whoa, hold on. This is not all that I do. I do way more as a product manager, and you're 100% right. But looking at these 5 things is a good way to look at some of the core differences between consumer and enterprise. So let's talk about ideas, generating ideas. Ideas for your feature, ideas for your product, ideas for enhancements. Where do you get these ideas? You get these ideas from lots of different places, sources, and channels. A number one way to get ideas is from customers. And as a PM, you might run focus groups, you might do user research, you might run surveys to get feedback from your customers. Another channel of ideas is competitive analysis. You look at the market, you look at potential competitors, you not only look at what their products are able to do, but you also look at where they're going, what is the direction that they're taking. Some of the times, really good ideas come internally. When you have smart people on your team working on interesting, challenging problems, then they end up coming up some really nice ideas that can really make your product better. But when you talk about enterprise and the world of enterprise products, an interesting channel or a key channel for ideas is your sales team or your sales engineering team. And the reason is your sales team is in constant contact with current clients, potential clients, and prospects, and listening to them and hearing from them on a continuous basis. Your sales team is on the ground holding meetings, having discussions, and hosting dinners and hearing from them. So in this process, the sales team or the sales engineering team collects a host of feedback that is indicative of the problems that your potential clients are facing and in turn generate ideas for your product. Here's an example of a case when the sales team identified an opportunity that wasn't obvious to me as a PM or to my team. So this is a while ago when a person on the sales team came to us, a group of 3 or 4 product managers, and said, hey, here's like a bunch of problems that the pharma industry is facing, and here's kind of like, you know, what they're looking to solve. And this was back when I was working at that retail analytics company. And we as a group of PMs went back, brainstormed a little bit, and found out that with just small tweaks, we could essentially pivot this retail product to sell to pharma. And all that we had to do, I still remember, were two changes. We had to change the wording on the product and load the data a little bit differently. And there it was. We could just sell this existing product to an entirely new vertical. As PMs, we look for 80-20s. But here was an 85, where with 5% of the effort, the work was already done. And the reason this happened was because the sales team kept an eye out not only for existing clients or potential clients that we were looking to target, but they were looking outside the window as well. And the second reason why this happened was because as a product team, we kept an open line of communication with the sales team. However, you also have to be careful sometimes. You can give your sales team too much leeway, and at the end of the day, they'll come back with must implement features. This is one of my favorite Dilbert comic strips. I apologize for people at the back who might not be able to see this. But basically what it illustrates is the kind of subtle balancing act that us PMs have to do sometimes when we navigate the world between sales and engineering, essentially. And this problem essentially shows up when there are opportunities that are hard to miss. So for instance, when our product team or our sales team was looking to sell a product in the Australian market, entering this Australian market for the first time, selling to a top bank, they came back to us and said, you know what, we wanted to get that contract signed, so we sold them something that didn't exist. And I was like, oh my God, what am I gonna tell my engineers? I felt terrible, but it had to get done because the contract was signed there. And in the end, the engineers had to really scramble and get this thing done. And trust me, they will not be happy. So what is our takeaway? Our takeaway is when you're considering ideas and considering them for implementation, you have to play this tug of war with sales or your sales engineering team. And the reason is sometimes they come up with great ideas. They'll make your product way better than you'd ever imagined. And sometimes you just simply need to stand your ground. And as PMs, you will be expected to play that role. And so that's our first takeaway. Now, let's jump to roadmap. Roadmap is one of my favorite words. It is where my dreams and visions are materialized in like a physical manner and where exciting things lie for our users. It's like a really exciting place. So now you have a bunch of ideas and you need to prioritize them, figure out when they get implemented, and so that you can go to your engineering team and say, hey, here's an order in which we will go and implement these features. So you're the PM, you learned something in you read up a product management book and you said, okay, I will whip up a nice prioritization matrix. I'll do this cost benefit analysis. I will figure out what is the benefit from a bunch of ideas. What is the cost of certain ideas? I'll calculate ROI and voila, I'm done. I've set my engineering team up for success and they know exactly what is coming when and they can plan for it and so on, right? Not really. Enter Walmart. So Walmart, you probably heard of it, is a behemoth in the retail industry. And especially when it comes to brick and mortar stores, it is like the queen. And if you haven't really read numbers around Walmart, even today, they account for about 11% of all retail sales. And what that means is one in every $9 being spent in the US on retail is being spent at Walmart. So there might be people saying, oh, Amazon is catching up, and they are, but that's like a different story and a different talk. But if you're operating in the retail space or any space like that, Walmart is big fish. It is the hardest fish to catch, but once you catch it, catching other fish is way easier. Now, Walmart was one of 100 clients at my previous company. But when you have major clients like that, they tend to influence a Porter forces type effect. Because they are such a key buyer, they have a huge bargaining power on your product, on your organization, on your company's leadership team, if that's the case. And in enterprise, it is not atypical for a single client to account for 30, 40, maybe even 50% of the revenue. That was not the case for Walmart, but we still had the following things for them. We had the largest dedicated team for them. We had an independent office all the way in Bentonville, Arkansas, which just for Walmart and their affiliates. We were deploying code specifically to their servers once, And then for all the other clients, you would deploy the code again. So separate data center where they hosted their data and their code. We had teams building new products for them just as an independent for an independent client. So what that meant was because a major client enjoyed that status, it meant that if they asked a specific feature for us, we had to prioritize that right away and build it right away. And so let us talk about my first feature as a PM. So I was tasked of building a simple feature, which was to publish certain results to Walmart's internal reporting system. Conceptually, feature was really, really simple. You have a bunch of results. All you need to do is flag them as, yes, published, not published. And then you have like a simple script that takes these results and dumps them into Walmart's system. Easy enough. But we had to prioritize this feature way ahead of others. But not only that, we had to do it in such a short time that we came up with this like really weird hacky implementation. We had a generic data model for all of our product, and we ended up adding this column, published result for Walmart, which was null for 100 clients, but it was just like ones and zeros just for this one client. So you can see the kind of influence that one single client can have in influencing your roadmap. Same thing at Dropbox, especially when we are looking to sell to large enterprises or clients. What happens is typically they come back to us with specific requests, and it's up to the product manager to consider them or not. So what's my takeaway for the roadmap? It is to watch for the whales. So if you're a product manager on an enterprise client, typically there might be one or two whales that you need to keep an eye out on, because they can influence your organization, request your features, and really rock your roadmap boat. And then as a PM, you need to navigate your engineering team through this work and make sure that they're shielded from any potential impact. Cool. Now we're getting into the meat of the presentation. Let's talk about specifications and building them. Now you've gotten the ideas, you've created the roadmap, and it's time to write the specifications so that your engineering team can go and build this feature for you. At Dropbox, one of our company values is a cupcake. It is this smiling pink cupcake with stars shooting from its head. And what it represents is it represents the delight that a user needs to experience when they use our product. And when you are a PM writing specifications for a feature, you're looking to essentially develop that delight in the user when they use your product. And as a PM, this is constantly on your mind. You're striving for your end user to have that kind of experience. So how do you go about that? As a PM, you think really deeply about your user. You care about what are my user's goals? What kind of business problems are they trying to solve? Does that align with what my company and what my product does? And then you start thinking about user stories. You think about how your solutions might fit into your users' lives. And then you work with a designer, come up with a design, write specs, and so on. But when you talk about the enterprise world, it's different. It's different because the person who's using the product is often different from the person who's buying the product. And when you're in the enterprise world, you don't not only need to care about the user, but you also need to care about the person who is swiping his credit card, who is writing that check for you, or who's the key decision maker for your client adopting that product. And in reality, this manifests in a couple of different practical ways. The first is when enterprise clients adopt a product, they typically run a pilot of your product initially, which is like a trial period for them to evaluate how well the product works and so on. At the end of the trial period, they end up signing like a longer term contract to license your product for a longer term. And at that point, you want this buyer or this decision maker to ideally champion your product. Another scenario where this might manifest itself is if you are in an early stage growth product, you're typically looking to get some meetings so that you can run some pilots with potential prospects or organizations. At that point, you look to essentially focus more on the buyer because that's who you need to convince to essentially get a pilot going for your product. 5 or 10 years ago, enterprise product management was very different. it was very, very buyer or decision maker focused. And if you were to look at like a legacy product from 5 years ago, you would see that there was a ton of features crammed into it with very little thought given to UX or, you know, end user experience. But that's changing. And the reason why this was done, by the way, before was because that's who PMs prioritized. That's who PMs cared about. And all that the buyers cared about was, okay, does this have the functionality to do X, Y, and Z? But now things have changed. With the consumerization of product management, with the consumerization of enterprise products, we need to care both about the end user as well as the buyer. So taking like a neutral product like Slack, for instance, great product doing, like killing it in the enterprise world. And what have they prioritized? Great design for their end users. So how does this manifest at Dropbox? Dropbox is primarily a collaboration product. We want our end users to collaborate, so we build a whole bunch of features around it. Collaboration features, sharing, previews, and so on. And when we do so, we want to pay the utmost attention to that end user experience, get them that cupcake that we always talk about. But it's not just about that. We also care about what the buyer and the users, buyer and the decision makers care about. And what they care about is things like the administrator experience. They care about things like security. They care about things like access control. They care about how Dropbox as a product would be deployed and integrated with the rest of the systems that they have going on. And if you're a PM, for instance, at, you know, a large enterprise software company, you might end up being the PM on one of these teams. And you might care a little more about that end user, or you might care a little more about that the buyer or that decision maker. But in practice, you're working really closely and collaborating with other PMs, and jointly you're thinking about the user and the buyer. So what's the takeaway when it comes to specifications? When you're writing specifications, you think deeply about users and you think about cupcakes. But when it comes to enterprise product, you need to think about bringing two cupcakes to the party. You need to bring not only one cupcake for your user or your end user, but you also need to bring one for your buyer. And what that means is only when both your user and the buyer are truly happy with your product will your product be successful. So now it's delivery time. It's time to ship. It's the most exciting time for a product manager. It is the culmination of weeks or maybe months of hard work that you've done to essentially get these ideas, build the roadmap, write the specs, build it with your engineers, QA it, and you're about to hit the launch button. What happens? Your client doesn't want the feature anymore. And you're in despair. You're like, oh my God, what happened? What went wrong? And the insight is that when you're talking about enterprise products, it takes time for a client to adopt these products. Your clients and users have to learn the product, and they have to undergo a steep learning curve to make sure that they can use the product and all the functionality that it has to offer. Your product in an enterprise doesn't sit within a silo. It's typically used in combination with other services and products, so there needs to be integrations that need to get built. And as your users learn the product and build some of these integrations, they create workflows for themselves. And your product will figure somewhere in their workflow. And what happens when you ship features is users end up being resistant to change, especially when your features break their workflows. As a PM, you might ship something that you think makes your product nicer, but your users are evaluating it from the context of their overall workflows. You might follow the mantra, ship, move fast and break things, but what you'll end up breaking is your contract or your SLA. So really, shipping is tricky. And so what the takeaway that I want to share with you all for delivery or when it comes to ship your product is to pay attention to the feature and really think about whether it helps your user. And think about announcing it in advance and prepping your users, giving them some time to adopt. And in typically what you can do is maybe even train your users. One quick story that I can share here from my own experience is I was looking to build improved Excel exports from the product. Every user was asking, like, let's get more improved Excel exports. We need more columns, more data, and everything in there. But it was not as easy as building that feature because downstream, a lot of clients had built macros in Excel on top of that export. And now if we were to change this format and ship something which made my product and my export nicer, it would break all these macros. So we had to think very deeply about how we would ship this, how we would make users transition, how would we like enable them to like write these macros and so on and so forth. So really the takeaway here is to pay attention and not ship features automatically because you might inadvertently break some of their workflows. So finally, it is time to get feedback and come full circle. A/B tests, great way to get feedback in the consumer world. It is pretty much a standard process, and now everyone does it. If you use a typical consumer product, they do thousands of experiments a year, and at any time you use the product, you might be subject to like hundreds of experiments. And when you run an A/B test, you take a feature, you expose it to a random subset of your users, and then you figure out whether there was a statistically significant difference in your metrics, and then use that to make certain decisions for rolling it out. And if a specific variant wins, you then ramp it up to say 5%, 10%, 30%, and so on. And at any point, if things go wrong, you can either hold off on rolling it out, or maybe you can roll back as well. But what about the enterprise? There are two major obstacles when it comes to A/B testing in the enterprise. The first is that you have far lesser traffic in the enterprise world just because you have far fewer number of users. And what that means is it takes an enormous time for you to get statistically significant results on your A/B test. And especially if you made a small change on a button three pages down on like a settings panel somewhere, you will probably get really no traffic, and it might take you many months to even see any signal in whether this feature was good or not. And so what happens there then is in the consumer world, when you have millions of users coming in, you have like high traffic, you get that signal really fast and you can run A/B tests, but enterprise world, not so much. The second reason why you cannot run A/B tests is when you run A/B tests, you need to randomize your user group. And in the enterprise world, you might be constrained in doing so because you might have contracts which say all users at a particular client need to have the same experience. And so you really truly cannot randomize the experience for across your entire user base, and you might have to ship it to certain clients, not to other clients, and so on. So how do you get feedback then? Obviously, I talked about getting feedback from the sales team, getting feedback from all these other channels. But as a PM, one of my pieces of advice is to listen and watch your customers at every possible opportunity, especially your end users. A great example for getting feedback is to attend rollout meetings where a client is looking to sign a longer term license following the pilot. And that's where you'll hear the deepest criticisms for your product. You'll hear the you'll hear the biggest gaps that your product has in meeting client use cases. But other potential opportunities could involve product training sessions, client visits. Hey, the sales team is visiting the client, I'll like join along. You can hop in on sales calls and hear what users have, or you can attend conferences if your client or if your company holds some of them. But the bottom line is when it comes to enterprise and getting feedback, it's just not all about the numbers. It is, it's okay if you don't look at your entire customer base, slice and dice the customer segments every which way. It's okay if you don't run A/B tests to optimize every single button, every single page. What you care more about is what your customers or your clients are saying, what they're showing you. You care a lot more about the relationships that you are building with your client, the relationship that your users have with your product, and that those kind of softer things matter a lot more than just looking at weekly active users, just looking at some conversion rate somewhere. because it's a lot more relationship-based. It's a lot more kind of interpersonal that way. So when we recap, when it comes to ideas and considering them, play the tug of war with your sales teams or your sales engineering teams. When it comes to looking at your roadmap and considering them, considering ideas, watch for the whales. In building specifications or writing requirements, think about cupcakes for not just your user, but your user and your buyer. When you're shipping products, think about, does shipping really help? Or am I just breaking their workflows and causing my user frustration? And finally, when it comes to feedback, it is more than looking at just numbers. It is about relationships. It's about looking at the other user as a person and building that kind of interpersonal contact with them. And so that was my 5 takeaways from this presentation. And with that, I will open up for questions. Yes. Yeah, so typically it is, so just to repeat the question, what do I do as a PM to share success stories with my engineering team? Is that a fair characterization? Revenue generation, yeah. So I think it really depends. So good examples are when there are pilots that we run, and let's say, for instance, the Walmart feature was like an example, but let's say we are building a specific feature to win a client. If we sign the client, then typically sales might say like, hey, here's a sales win, and you keep an eye out as a PM. Hey, we built this feature for client X or for that pilot contract. Did we win that pilot? And if we won that pilot, typically you will send an email out to your engineering team saying, hey, guess what? We built this feature. We ended up signing that client. In smaller enterprise companies, what happens is when you have like 10 or 15 clients, typically a client win is sent out to the whole company. And then it's not only your engineering team, but like every engineering team knows, hey, we won this client, basically. Right. Yeah. Hey, yeah.
So Dropbox uses any specific kind of tools to track down all the process, like from ideation to feedback. It may not be a separate, may not be only whole one, maybe a separate one for ideation, maybe for feedback.
So the question is, I guess, what kind of tools do we use from a product manager's perspective for each of these steps? It really depends, actually. And I'll talk more of, instead of Dropbox, I'll probably talk more generically. It really varies. For instance, my previous company, we used to use like all Atlassian products. So we used to like keep track of our roadmap, ideas, everything in Atlassian's Confluence, and use Jira to track projects. At Dropbox, we use Dropbox Paper, which is our collaboration product. And then we, for task management, we end up using, or even for idea mapping, roadmaps, tracking roadmaps, and also like writing requirements, and feedback as well. But for like something like task management, there's like a variety of tools. Depends and varies from team to team.
When folks from your sales team say, okay, we have all these massive deals that depend on this feature, how do you make a decision on whether to kind of divert resources there or just say, you know, we're just going to lose these deals and stick to, you know, our current path? Like, how do you balance that? And then how do you justify it internally to, you know, the director of sales who's just lost $1 million or something?
Yeah. Oh, boy. by the way, I can never justify to the director of sales that I lost $1 million. Just setting the context there. But the question was, how do you justify, or how do you make trade-offs between pilot one-off single client opportunities versus like broader pieces? So the way I try to kind of think about like these pilot features, and this is like the more you work in enterprise, the more you tend to think about this, especially when you're building one product that caters to everything. There are enterprise clients that customize specific, you know, products for specific clients, but let's say we are in a world where the same product is being used everywhere. One of the primary things that I try to think of is see whether what they're asking for can be made more generic and made more broader, and see whether that can capture some potential use cases that other clients might have in the future, or some related use cases that they might have said that they might have, like, you know, asked for in another way. So that's like one trick where you would say, like, oh, let's not build just this one feature for this one client, we'll make it more generic. But if it is like really one-off customizations, at the end of the day, in most of my experience particularly, it has been like, you know, what is the revenue impact of X doing X now versus doing Y for like a larger user base? So that really depends on, you know, it also depends a little bit on the dynamic that exists. Like in some companies, like sales has like a stronger voice. In some companies, product has a stronger voice. So it touches a little bit on the organizational dynamic at that point. If the organization is a little more sales oriented, you can fight as a PM, but sometimes you have to back down. But sometimes if you're in a more product oriented organization, you tend to have like a lot more, I guess, leeway to push back. But at the end of the day, it comes back to like, you know, some revenue quantification that you can make. But as a PM, you can have like a bag of tools that you can try to pull out to make this a little bit smoother. You had a question, yes?
In the last session on feedback, you mentioned the importance of relationship building with clients. You did not talk about relationship building with the team that is developing the product for the client. How do you build those relations? How do you build the soft skills of engineers within the team to make sure that it succeeds? And then in Dropbox, if the team pulls out, what's the support that you get from the company to rebuild, repair, revive?
Yep.
And not endanger the product because
So there were two questions there. The first question was, how do you build relationships with your team, with your engineering team, and, you know, develop that soft skills? And then the second question was, what happens if your team fails? How does, you know, a company like Dropbox handle this? So the first question is, I would say the number one thing when I start on a new engineering team is volunteer for everything. Like, okay, like you're annoyed with this? Okay, you don't worry about this, I'll do this. You're annoyed with support? Okay, don't do this, I'll do this. And it doesn't matter what level you're at, it doesn't matter like who you are. Your engineering team is looking at what value you bring to the team. And so number one thing, this is like a generic advice outside of enterprise, outside of like any like boundaries. If you are a PM, your number one job is to be useful. Forget roadmaps, forget all these like 5-6 different things, right? Number one job is to be useful. Number two, building some of that software skills. I like to do that with, you know, the smaller things. I like to sit with my team, number one. Number two, I make it a point to have lunch with my team, because usually what happens is PMs get lunch meetings. You're doing some work somewhere, whereas all of your engineers are sitting together. But I make it a point to prioritize lunch with my team. Then the third thing is, engineers usually like to play board games. They like to, you know, play foosball or table tennis. I have like a bunch of new engineers join my team who loved foosball. So what I did was I organized like a bi-weekly Friday foosball fun event where we all go play foosball for half an hour. And it is like these small points of bonding that make it easier for you to have like an open line of communication with your engineers. And they may just like become friends with you and they trust you. And if there is something wrong, if they have that social connection, they will just like share that with you. They will be open and say like, hey, you did this, but maybe we should have done this. But if you are like distant and cold, they are much like less likely to say that to you, and they will write it in your performance report. So the second question, you don't want that. So the second question was, how does Dropbox handle failures? And I will probably answer with how should a company, and this is my personal answer, how should a company deal with product failures? I think like most companies, and this is true of Dropbox as well, is you have a core-based product. Most successful companies, you have a core successful product, and then you're extending on to see like, you know, can I grab this, move into this adjacent market? Can I grab that? Can I move that? And so you're in some ways like making these moves and taking moonshot projects. And they are bound to fail. So what you need to do, or what companies need to do, and they do, maybe there are exceptions, is to trust the people and to trust that we or the team did its best job to try and deliver it. Success is not necessarily guaranteed. And this is true of even for like a startup or any product or any feature that you're working on. It's not guaranteed, but you just need to trust the people, and you just need to trust like, hey, the people are doing their best, and the process and the way we are doing things is aligned with, you know, is not really obstructing success. So that's the, probably the best you can do. Yeah?
Yeah, so you talk about specs. How specific do you spec out users? Are they implementable right from the get-go? And then how do you, what's your best way of that you talk to convey that spec to the user?
Yeah. So the question was, what is the best, to what level of detail do I write specs, and how do I communicate it with the engineering team? Is that a fair characterization? The answer actually depends on, so the first question, how, what level of detail do I write specs? The answer depends on this level of seniority of the engineer to a little extent. And the reason is, if I'm working with an engineer who has been on that product surface area for like 5 years, and they know the in and outs of not just the product, but they know how users use the product. They have, like, good team leads and good EMs have a very good sense of, like, product. They have a good sense of what use cases are, why their feature exists, why their product surface area exists. So it's okay if you kind of keep things at the high level sometimes, especially if it's a smaller feature. They can, like, make those leaps because they've been there, they know what edge cases exist, and so on. But if you're getting a brand new intern on your team who's a sophomore who's never done, like, a product or like worked on a product team before, you have to like really write and spec out every single thing. You have to write the wording, you have to write like, hey, here's how it should look like, here's where the semicolon should be, everything. So it really depends on, it really depends on kind of the seniority of the engineer in my perspective. The second question was, how do I communicate this with the engineers? So there have been like asynchronous and asynchronous ways in which I've done this in the past. The synchronous way is we used to have this meeting called a sprint planning meeting where all the engineers sit and we used to like say, hey, here are like the n number of features which will go into our next sprint. And then I walk through the mockups and I guess like to a high level, like walk through the requirements and like give an overview of what that is. But there have also been scenarios where I write a document and then just like share it with someone and then say like, hey, just look through this, comment on it. Most of the cases when it has been asynchronous, I follow like a leveled approach where I first share it with like the team lead or the tech lead and they look at it, maybe share it with other PMs and then maybe go one level lower. Cool, yes.
How much time are you spending in pilots versus regular
Oh, what percentage of the time do I work on pilots versus like the team and like the product team versus on pilots? That really depends on the company and the product that you're working on. If you're working on like a new growth product, you'll be signing like a ton of like new pilots, so you would end up simply like, you know, working on pilot features all the time. If you are on like a more mature organization, then you'll essentially be building newer features for existing clients, and so it's less likely to be a pilot. The one caveat that I will say is renewals or contract renewals are like pilots in some sense. In the sense that, let's say you have like $1 million contract signed and there's a renewal time coming up, you're like sweating bullets at that point, or your like sales team is sweating bullets and they might request some features. And at that point, you'll perceive it as a pilot, even though it is like, you know, they have signed contract and they used your product for 3 or 4 years. The second one, like, I personally think less about the process. I think more about like the deliverable. In most cases, just for context, I've always like followed like the Scrum methodology in most of my teams. But I don't know, I just think that like process is only a means to an end. Yeah, I'll give you.
I have two questions.
Sure.
You have your roadmap, there's customer requests, the engineering teams identify things that they could do that they want to put in the work. How do you balance that, all of those three sources of work, so that, you know, you can maintain your roadmap and product integrity, you can have big customers getting what they want,
yeah,
but also like kind of longer term investment in the platform of the product. The question is balance.
Got it.
The second one is, do you visualize your product management work? That you and that other people can kind of see at a glance what the status is on the product management, product development workflow?
So the first question was, how do you ensure the balance between, I guess, like client-related features versus more foundational technical debt-type features? And the second, and my vision, basically. Okay. And then the second one is, second one was like, how do you visualize? Like, I'll answer the second question first.
Okay.
The way I do this is like, I mean, it's like depends on the tools that I use. Usually the way I try to do this, like share like a very visual roadmap that shows like, here's the engineer capacity that we have on the team. Here's like the set of features that are showing up. Usually like teams end up having work streams. So what I do is I color code, like, I mean, this is like a very like visual diagram, I guess then. Like each work stream will have like a certain color code and I will just show like almost like a Gantt chart type visualization. It's pretty easy, especially if I'm sharing this with sales or senior people. One visual, it gives them a sense of what's coming up and what's going on. So tech debt versus I guess like other client related features or vision. I guess like prioritizing tech debt is like challenging, right? You can always put it away until it comes and bites you in the back. What I do is I really rely on my tech lead's opinion on like when and how we should do this. And really what that means is I've never in reality spent an entire sprint with all my engineers working on tech debt. Usually what I've done is if there's a quarter where we need to work on tech debt and we have like three goals for the team, one of those goals ends up being a tech debt work. And like you will usually, or in my experience at least, what I've done is have some ongoing work for client or kind of like foundational vision oriented work, but you have like a part of the team dedicated to tech debt. So it's like kind of working on like a handicap or like a resource constrained way. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Cool. Yes.
Yeah. You commented about working with engineers and building relationships.
I'm
wondering what your experience and take is on working with product marketing. And I know that it changes from company to company, but and if you can comment on your take on their sort of usefulness and, you know.
Let's see. So I guess like the biggest way I work with product marketing is, let's say I built a feature or like, you know, part of a product that was really wildly successful. And I personally think that this feature can be used by a lot more, like, you know, a lot more clients. It needs to kind of go out there and be broader. So what I worked with the product marketing in that case is, you know, take the example of what we built and how it was successful. Work with marketing to create certain case studies and create like kind of like a templated case study, make it more generic, make it like kind of sanitize, like remove like, you know, sensitive information and so on. And so now you have this white paper, which kind of like what marketing generates. And now work with marketing to kind of send out those white papers at maybe like conferences, at client meets and so on. So now what I'm doing in a sense is like becoming the de facto salesperson for my feature and for my team. So because there is like this aspect of discoverability of features where you can say, I built this awesome thing, it exists somewhere and clients may or may not discover it. But if you build a white paper that goes out to like a bunch of clients, then they may ask some questions about it, then they may start using it, and then you might get some more feedback on how you can improve it. So that's how I worked with product marketing in the past, mostly like kind of generating success stories and sharing them with everyone. Yes.
When it comes to balancing a large group of engineers' time, you have a complex product and you want to communicate all of the, you know, all the different components put together. How do you keep your meetings like, you know, productive so you don't really worry about, you know, talking to specific engineers when you have people working on the same overall project?
Yeah. So the right answer there and how I've done this in the past is you really need to, so every engineering team will have like you as a PM, you'll have an EM who essentially manages kind of the engineers and their allocation to projects and how whether they're happy or not happy, and then the tech lead who essentially works on like different projects. What I try to do is leverage these two people, like EM and tech lead, in a very heavy manner to essentially let them figure out some of these answers. Like, I will probably, as a PM, not go and say, hey, this engineer should work on this, or that engineer should work on that. Instead, I will say, this work needs to get done, and here's kind of the timeline, here's kind of what fits into the sprint. And then the EM, or the tech lead, depending on how these roles play out on your own team, will come back to me and say, hey, but we have like three backend guys, and they're all working on this, but you have put up another backend feature that we may not like really work. What about this like front-end feature that we are prioritizing for next sprint? What if we push that up and push that back-end feature down so we have like a little bit of bandwidth? So what that means is when you work with your EM or tech lead, you have to play this balancing act, because you have to play this like, even though you have resources as an engineer or as an engineering team, not all those resources are equal, because sometimes someone's more specialized in something else and so on. So I tend to exclusively like leverage the help of like the EM and the tech lead to make those decisions. When I'm in one of those like larger sprint meetings with like, you know, the full engineering team, I play the role of answering questions, and I play the role of answering or giving the user context to the engineer. I say, hey, you're working on this. The reason why we need to build this is X, Y, and Z. So make sure that engineer understands why they're building it and has a certain amount of empathy for the end user. Yeah, I'll give him a chance. Yeah, that's a good question. And really what the PM does in a week or over the course of many months really depends on which part of the cycle you are in for the feature that you're building. Let's say you're generating ideas and you want to crystallize the ideas. You're spending a lot of upfront time talking to users, figuring out, you know, do I really understand these user stories? Do I really understand the use cases? Do I really understand what's going on? But let's say you're coming a little bit further down the line when you're developing like the design and the requirements, you are working a lot more closely because you now understand what the users want and what perspectives they will seek from your feature. You're spending a lot more time with the design folks. You're spending a lot more time with your tech lead, figuring out those trade-offs. Like, hey, can we build this solution? Will this work? Will this still keep our estimates in the same kind of like time range that we had originally thought of? Because when you ask an engineer about like an initial upfront like time, they'll just give you like a very rough estimate. But a lot of the devil is in the details, and that's when you start figuring it out. And that's when you probably spend less time talking to users. Maybe there's a little bit of back and forth, but you're spending majority of the time working with kind of your team and the design folks. Later down the cycle, you'll work with QA, release like marketing, comms, and so on. So that I would say like the percent of time really varies where I am in that cycle. It depends on the feature, to be honest, because like some features could be like a large feature can, and I cannot answer like in detail because I've only worked on a few projects, but some of them could be years, some of them could be like a quick ship, could be like, you know, a few weeks. So it just varies a lot. Yeah. Back there. Got it. So the question is, if you have a siloed team, and when you say siloed team, presumably you're referring to like a team that works by itself on like a large surface area with no contact.
Yeah, in my case, more like the engineers themselves are very kind of focused, very specific on a specific area.
Mm.
Or for a very small company.
Okay, versus like a larger company where you have like. Let's see whether how can answer that question. So let's say you have a siloed team that's working by itself on like, you know, a large product area versus like, you know, versus a team that maybe has to like, you know, there's a bunch of different teams and, you know, there's like a lot of coordination involved. When there's a lot of coordination involved, I coordinate at like my level, which means like I coordinate with other PMs. I tend to rarely, like if I'm the PM of a team that is like doing some work very closely in relation to another team which has a PM or an EM, I very rarely like go into the details of that other team, practically never. And instead I try to keep the communication at the higher level and say like, you know, having like PM syncs where we have like one-on-ones, talk more about like, here's what we are doing, does that align with your vision, does that align with your timelines and so on. and making sure that the communication with across like the PM and the EM and the tech lead level is strong is kind of what I try to ensure. If it's like a siloed team, it's more like a startup, which is like you are like you don't care about the world, you know about your users, you're just like focused like building kind of, you know, trying to ship things and like trying to build something quickly, trying to get users to see things and so on. So that's the way I guess I would like look at things. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I cannot, I guess, answer this. I cannot answer this question. And by the way, for those listening, and I guess, the question is, if a major competitor launches a product or a feature that is getting a ton of traction, what do you do as a PM, or what have you done? I don't think I can answer this question of what have I done, because that has not happened, fortunately, I guess. But what would I do? I guess it really depends on like how much traction it is getting. And if it is getting a ton of traction, we would probably end up like prioritizing this. Like, and it is like, at the end of the day, it's a business, right? You have to win business. You have to stop losing business. And if you are losing business because of this feature, chances are you will like keep everything aside and then like go into like crazy, let's like try to build this in like X days mode and then like crank it out. There will be immense pressure on your team to deliver. And this is, you've seen examples of this, right? I mean, I guess like there are examples in the consumer side of the world for more popular reasons, like Instagram stories or whatever, and a bunch of other examples. Like, you will end up building this feature. I personally haven't been in that spot, but I can imagine that happening to me if that were the case. Yeah. Yes.
In a competitive environment like enterprise sales, where you have, you know, Google Drive and
So the question, I guess, is if you have a lot of competitors and then the whale is requesting features that a competitor has, how do you like prevent just working for the whale and not like having like a generic broad roadmap? The way this works and has worked for me in the past is, at the end of the day, it also depends a little bit on the sales team. And really, like when you look at like competing products, and even if you look at Dropbox versus other products, there are certain areas where our, like, you know, Dropbox stands like shoulders and heads above like kind of competing products. There might be other dimensions where we might not have a certain feature or something. So it is like a combination of not just building exactly what all they want, but it's a combination of selling like, hey, we have this, whereas the stuff that you're looking at doesn't have that. And so highlighting some of those differences and pointing them out, like, hey, here's, you know, you should use Dropbox because it's better in these four dimensions and it matters to you. And a little bit of the job is not just my own as a PM. A lot of that responsibility also falls on the sales team, because they want to keep the whale, but they also, like, you know, have like a bunch of other clients that they need to protect. And it's not about, like, you know, especially when it comes to Dropbox, like, we have like hundreds of thousands of like enterprises using our product. The whale, I guess, analogy is less applicable for us in some sense. Yeah. Yes.
I forgot the question.
All right. I'll ask. Get you. Yeah. 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 So there is. Oh, by the way, yes. You should definitely. You should definitely front load this. But when you're building small features, the example that I shared was like a, hey, let's build something quick and ship, and like, oh, okay, like this is something that happened, kind of a thing. Definitely think more about like workflows. That is like a pretty strong advice. How do I go about doing that? Like, really, it's hard if you listen to like indirect customer feedback. If you listen to indirect sources, like you run a survey or you like you talk to your sales team, you will hear less about those interfaces. A lot of the interfaces or the interface world, you will hear directly from the user. Because you can ask like, okay, you moved this file here, what would you do afterwards? How would you use this? So it's about like having the opportunity maybe to use user research or by yourself asking some of those questions in an active manner, looking at like kind of the boundaries of the product and saying like, okay, what are users using this endpoint for? And that's the way I've done this in the past, like just ask and like explore that area, because it's pretty easy to figure out like kind of the, if you look at your product as a box, pretty easy to figure out this, but like kind of the edges become blurry. And so you have to actively think about like, you know, where the edges lie and where they're connecting to other systems and so on. Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah, I'll give that opportunity. I'll hang out, by the way. You guys can come and ask me questions afterwards. Yes. Integrate into my own? Sorry. Oh, got it. So the question is, I guess if I were building a product for a bunch of clients, but I was also using that product myself, how would I think about incorporating like some of my own benefits? Like are the benefits for my own like? Yeah, so for instance, like the question, I guess to reframe better is like, hey, like clients are asking X for Dropbox. What do I think about like Dropbox as a company improving processes by incorporating this business, incorporating or building this feature? In reality, very little, to be honest. Because if there are two features, one gives benefit to Dropbox, but one gives benefit to client, prioritize the benefit to the client one. If there are two features, both of which benefits client approximately equally, but one of which benefits Dropbox a little bit more, maybe there's a reason for prioritizing that a little bit ahead. But when I have done PMing, very little of it has been like, hey, like let's think about like how it helps our company. A lot more is like kind of client focused. Yeah.
Okay, well,
cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.